The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious, essential knowledge simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI.
Welcome back to The Deep Dive.
Today we're jumping into a really fascinating period, the late 19th and early 20th centuries. It was this thrilling, kind of turbulent time that completely shook up storytelling.
Absolutely. Our subject is modern drama.
And this isn't just about, you know, stuffy old plays gathering dust somewhere.
Not at all. It's really about understanding that moment when theater stopped being just, well, simple entertainment.
Right.
And it became this controversial intellectual laboratory for society. I mean, the rules for character, plot, even what reality looked like on stage, they were totally broken down and then remade.
Completely remade. So our mission today is to unpack the core ideas from Kirsten E. Shepherd Barr's fantastic book, Modern Drama, a very short introduction. We want to get at why the drama from roughly the 1880s through the 1950s was just so revolutionary.
And it matters because, well, this period basically laid down the blueprints for almost all the complex storytelling we see today. You know, prestige TV, indie films.
So the DNA of modern narrative, really.
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. Think about things you appreciate now, like really nuanced characters, maybe non-linear plots, or even, you know, filmmakers breaking the fourth wall.
Yeah.
A lot of that language was really born right there on the modern stage. Hopefully by the end of this, you'll have a clearer sense of how to spot and understand those techniques.
Okay, sounds great. So let's start with the author, Kirsten E. Shepherd Barr. She's our guide through this. What makes her perspective so valuable here?
Well, first off, she's a professor of English and theater studies at Oxford. So the credentials are definitely there.
Right. Solid academic background.
But what's really interesting, what makes her take unique is her specialism.
Which is?
It's the intersection of science and literature. She wrote this key book called Science on Stage.
Okay, science and theater. That sounds maybe a bit unexpected. Isn't theater more about emotion, performance?
Well, that's kind of the core of her insight. Shepherd Barr argues that these huge revolutionary ideas from people like Charles Darwin and Sigmund Freud weren't just, you know, themes that playwrights might sprinkle into their plays sometimes.
So not just background inspiration.
No, much deeper than that. She argues they were fundamental forces, paradigm-shifting ideas that actually reshaped the very structure, like the grammar of how plays were written, how characters were built, how the stage itself worked.
Wow. So Darwin and Freud actually changed the tools playwrights used.
Exactly. They offered a new way to understand why people do what they do. It shifted from this idea of pure moral free will.
Good choices, bad choices.
Right. To something much more complex, a determined interplay of biology, your environment, and crucially, the subconscious mind.
That's a really powerful way to frame it, that the scientific revolution happening out there forced this massive internal artistic revolution on stage. Okay, let's get into the book's main argument then. What's the defining feature of modern drama, according to Shepherd Barr?
The central idea is that modern drama isn't defined by one single style. Instead, it's defined by this really contentious engagement with modernity, and specifically by the persistent tension between conflicting forces within drama itself.
So it's the argument between styles that defines it.
Precisely. It's the fierce, productive dialogue between them.
Can we boil that down? Like two main camps fighting it out?
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. On one side, you've got this drive towards objective reality. This is championed by realism and its more extreme cousin, naturalism.
The goal being?
To create a perfect mirror of life, almost scientific. The stage becomes this precisely observed, controlled slice of reality, like looking through a keyhole.
And that was a reaction against something, right? Shepherd Barr talks about what came before Ibsen, what he was rebelling against.
Oh, absolutely. Before Ibsen, the dominant form was the well-made play. Think very formulaic, totally predictable plots built on secrets, big reveals, convenient coincidences.
And a nice, neat ending where everything's resolved.
Exactly. Simple moral clarity. Pure entertainment, really. Ibsen just smashed that predictability.
Okay, so that deliberate smashing leads us to the other side of this tension, the rebellion against the mirror idea.
Which is subjective reality. This is where all the anti-realist movements come and all the isms, you know, symbolism, expressionism, futurism.
Their goal.
To express the inner world, dreams, the subconscious, chaos, maybe the spiritual realm. They completely rejected the realist idea that what you see on the surface is the ultimate truth.
So the whole period the book covers, like 1880s to the 1950s, is basically the story of this tug of war, the perfect mirror versus the broken, distorted mirror.
That's a great way to put it. That dynamic struggle is key.
Okay, let's dig into the starting point then. The moment it all kicks off with Henrik Ibsen, the so-called father of modern drama.
Right, Ibsen. His revolution wasn't just about style, though he changed that too. It was really about content. He took that old, creaky structure of the well-made play.
The predictable formula.
Yeah, and he basically injected it with really serious, often deeply uncomfortable social and psychological issues. He invented the problem play.
Designed to make people argue.
Exactly, to provoke intense public debate. Suddenly, theater wasn't just escapism. You had audiences storming out, furious, arguing about things like gender inequality in A Doll's House or the crushing weight of social hypocrisy and inherited disease in Ghosts.
He literally forced society to look at itself in this often unflattering mirror.
He did. And August Strindberg, another key figure, took Ibsen's realism and pushed it even deeper into psychological naturalism.
Naturalism being?
Even more deterministic. Plays like Miss Julie show characters almost trapped, their fates sealed by their environment, their class, their heredity. It's quite bleak.
But Strindberg didn't just stick to that, did he?
No, and that's what's so fascinating. He was doing this intense naturalism, but at the same time, he was pioneering these totally dreamlike, subjective plays, early expressionism, like a dream play.
So even the pioneers were wrestling with that core tension right from the start, realism versus something else.
Exactly. That internal chaos Strindberg explored wasn't just pulled out of thin air. Shepard Barr makes a strong case that it was directly informed by the scientific revolutions happening at the same time.
Okay, let's go there. You mentioned Darwin and Freud providing a new dramatic epistemology. What does that mean in practice?
Okay, dramatic epistemology sounds fancy, but it just means science changed how playwrights thought about what could be known or shown about a character on stage. It shifted the foundations.
How so?
Well, take Darwinism. The focus on heredity and environment meant characters became products of these sort of deterministic forces. A playwright couldn't just say anymore, oh, this character is evil because they chose evil.
Right. Now they had to show how things like their upbringing, their social conditions, maybe even their genetics led them there.
It's a massive philosophical shift on stage. And then, boom, comes Freud.
Psychoanalysis.
Right. And that gives playwrights this incredibly rich language for the subconscious, this hidden, irrational inner world driving our outward actions.
And that fueled both sides of the coin.
Doubly powerful, yeah. Gave realism this amazing psychological depth, made characters feel much more complex, contradictory.
More like real people.
Exactly. Oh. But simultaneously, it provided the entire toolkit for expressionism. Expressionism is basically trying to stage the subconscious mind itself, its fears, its desires, its distortions.
And Shepard Barr even connects it to physics. Einstein.
Yeah, it's maybe a bit more indirect, but the idea is swirling around relativity, uncertainty, this sense that the objective world itself wasn't fixed or easily knowable. That resonated deeply with playwrights who were already breaking up linear plots and stable ideas of character.
The ground felt unsteady scientifically, and the stage reflected that feeling.
You could say that. And all this scientific upheaval, this sense of inner chaos, directly fed into that anti-realist backlash we mentioned, the isms.
Okay, let's look at those isms, the main movements that pushed back hard against realism. First up, symbolism.
Symbolism, yeah. Think figures like Maurice Maeterlinck. They totally rejected surface reality. They wanted mood, mystery, suggestion.
How did they achieve that?
Through poetic language, very stylized staging, trying to evoke this unseen world, fate, hidden spiritual forces. They weren't really interested in social problems. It was all about the inner mysterious life.
Okay, then things get maybe a bit more intense with expressionism.
Definitely more intense. Expressionism, especially big in Germany, was all about projecting the inner psychological reality of a tormented main character onto the stage.
So what would that look like?
Visually, it's often distorted. Scenery might be jagged at weird angles. Colors could be harsh, clashing. Characters often aren't fully rounded individuals, but more like archetypes, shouting figures representing broader ideas or states of mind.
Like Edvard Munch's The Scream turned into a play.
That's a perfect analogy. It's externalized anguish, putting the inside on the outside visually.
Okay. Yeah. And the most anarchic of the bunch, futurism.
Oh, yeah, futurism. An Italian movement led by Marinetti. They were obsessed with the machine, age speed, technology, even violence.
What were their plays like?
They wanted to shock, completely demolish tradition. You wrote these things called synthetic plays, super short, often illogical, deliberately confrontational. Their manifesto is literally called for burning down museums and libraries.
Right, so not exactly aiming for a quiet night at the theater.
Definitely not. Provocation was the entire point. Forget enjoyment.
So once you have this level of artistic chaos and often political intent mixed in, you get to drama that's explicitly political, like Shaw and Brecht.
Exactly. George Bernard Shaw first. He used incredible wit and paradox, clever arguments, and what he called the drama of ideas.
To push his own political views.
Absolutely. He was a Fabian socialist, believed in gradual, rational social reform. So his plays became these platforms for debating capitalism, class, social hypocrisy, very intellectual, very talky, but often very funny.
Using the theater as a sort of public forum?
Well, Socratic forum, yeah. But then you get Bertolt Brecht, and that's where the relationship with the audience takes another radical turn.
Okay, Brecht. He's famous for epic theater and...
Verfremdung's effect, the V effect, usually translated as the alienation effect or distancing effect.
And the goal of that was...
Brecht didn't want the audience to get lost in the story, to empathize emotionally and just, you know, cry. He thought that was passive, politically useless.
So he wanted to break the illusion.
Constantly. Remind you you're watching a play. He used techniques like having actors step out of character to address the audience, using songs that commented on the action, showing the stage lights, using placards to announce scenes.
Why? What was the point of kicking the audience out of the story?
To make them think. Critically. To judge the social and political situations being presented on stage, not just feel sympathy for the characters. Realism wants your empathy. Brecht demands your critical judgment.
That's a fundamental shift in what theater is for.
Huge. Now, Shepard Barr makes a really important point here. None of this radical experimentation, Ibsen's problem plays, Strindberg's expressionism, Brecht's political theater could have happened in the mainstream commercial theaters at the time.
They wouldn't stage it.
No way. Too risky, too weird, potentially offensive, not guaranteed to make money. So you needed a different kind of space.
And that's where the independent theater movement comes in?
Exactly. Little venues like the Théâtre Libre in Paris, the independent theater in London, they were crucial.
How did they operate?
Often subscription-based.
Yeah.
Small audiences, but dedicated ones. This meant they were free from the pressure of needing a huge commercial hit and, very importantly, free from official censorship.
So they acted like laboratories.
Perfect word. Protected laboratories where these radical new forms of drama could be tried out, could fail, could develop without being immediately shut down.
And this whole trajectory, this history of scientific doubt, psychological exploration, political argument, that eventually leads somewhere else after World War II.
Yeah, Shepard Barr suggests that the anxieties and innovations of modernism really provided the groundwork, the DNA, for the theater of the absurd. Think Samuel Beckett, Ionesco.
We're waiting for Godot.
Right. Plays that present a world seemingly devoid of meaning, of rational order. It's like the philosophical endpoint of modernism's wrestling with the loss of old certainties.
Wow. Okay, that's a lot to take in. Let's try to synthesize this. What are the key themes Shepard Barr really wants us to walk away with?
Well, one big one is definitely about the theater's role in society. We can call it theme. Theater as social laboratory and catalyst.
Meaning it wasn't just reflecting society, but actively trying to change it.
Exactly. It reclaimed the stage as a place for public debate. Ibsen's plays forced uncomfortable conversations. Mm. Shaw used it as an intellectual battleground. And you can connect that directly to today, right? Think about art, theater, film that challenges our assumptions about, say, climate change or social justice or mental health.
Using art to provoke thought and maybe action. Okay, what's another key theme?
This one connects back to Freud and the inner life. The fragmentation of the modern self.
How character changed.
Completely. Characters stopped being these sort of stable, morally clear figures. Influenced by psychoanalysis, they became much more fragmented, contradictory, driven by subconscious urges they didn't understand.
And the reflection for us.
Well, it's kind of validating, isn't it? The complexity, the contradictions, the messy inner lives we all experience, the modern stage, was one of the first places that really explored that seriously and said, yes, this is part of being human. It gives us permission to acknowledge our own psychological depth.
That's a great point. And a third theme.
It has to be about the audience, redefining the audience's role.
Moving from passive to active.
Precisely. Realism kind of wanted you to be a fly on the wall, just observing quietly. But many modernists, especially Brecht and the futurists, wanted to provoke you, activate you, force you to judge, maybe even react physically.
So the viewer becomes less of a consumer, more of a participant.
Or at least an active critical thinker. You're not just there to passively receive the story. you're implicated in judging its meaning and its relation to the real world.
Shepard Barr's book does a great job distilling these big ideas. Let's touch on a few memorable takeaways, almost like core quotes, that really capture her argument.
Okay, the first one really nails that central conflict we talked about, something like, modern drama is defined not by a single style, but by the fierce and productive dialogue between realism's desire to represent the world and anti-realism's insistence on expressing the inner self.
That tension again, it's the engine. What's another key insight?
This one highlights that unique science angle. The theories of Darwin and Freud were more than just thematic source material. They provided a new grammar for dramatic character, transforming human motivation from pure free will to a complex interplay of biology, environment, and the subconscious.
It really emphasizes that science gave them new building blocks for character.
It absolutely did. It changed the understanding of why people are the way they are.
And maybe one more about how this revolution actually managed to happen.
Right, the practical side. The new drama required a new kind of theatrical ecosystem. The independent theater, which acted as a protected laboratory for artistic experimentation.
The protected laboratory idea, yeah. It underlines that innovation needs space. It needs freedom from immediate commercial demands.
Yeah, that's a lesson that applies way beyond theater, I think.
Definitely. So how can we use all this understanding in our lives today? You mentioned media literacy earlier.
Absolutely. This framework, realism versus anti-realism, understanding techniques like the alienation effect. It gives you powerful tools for analyzing all sorts of modern media.
How so? Give us an example.
Okay, well, when you watch a gritty, hyper-realistic TV show where a character seems completely trapped by their terrible upbringing or social circumstances.
Like The Wire, maybe?
Perfect example. You can recognize the legacy of naturalism there, that sense of determinism. But then think about something like the movie The Big Short.
Where they kept breaking the fourth wall to explain finance.
Exactly. When characters stop the story, look at the camera, and explain a complex concept directly to you that's pure Brechtian alienation effect.
Yeah.
Or think of Fleabag.
Her asides to the camera.
Right. It deliberately pulls you out of just feeling her story and forces you, the viewer, to think about her actions, her motivations, her situation from a bit of a distance. You're judging as much as you're empathizing.
So recognizing these techniques helps us move beyond just passively consuming stories.
It helps you engage critically, to ask why the creator is using that technique, what effect they're trying to achieve. It makes you a smarter viewer.
I also think this whole story is a great case study in innovation and tradition.
For sure. It shows how major breakthroughs often come from a direct, sometimes quite aggressive rebellion against the established way of doing things. Realism seemed like the ultimate goal for a while.
Until it wasn't.
Until the isms came along and said, no, there's more to reality than just the surface. It encourages us, maybe in our own work or fields, to question the dominant paradigms. If the seemingly unshakable, well-made play could be overthrown, maybe today's conventions aren't as fixed as we think.
That's quite inspiring, actually. As we wrap up, what was the most surprising or valuable takeaway for you from revisiting this?
For me, I think it's really understanding why the formal experiments happened. The fragmentation, the breaking of illusion. It wasn't just playwrights being difficult or arty for the sake of it.
It was a response.
A necessary artistic response, I think, to a world where the old certainties, religious, social, scientific, were collapsing. The pre-modern worldview was breaking down, so the stage, in a way, had to break down too to reflect that.
That makes a lot of sense. The form had to match the feeling of the times.
And for me, the lasting insight is just how central the stage was as this laboratory. Shepard Barr really convinces you that this is where the massive epoch-defining ideas of Darwin, Marx, Freud, even Einstein weren't just discussed, they were dramatized. They were tested, visualized, argued about right there in front of audiences.
So understanding modern drama isn't just theater history.
It's fundamental intellectual history. It's understanding the birth of the modern world in many ways.
A fantastic way to frame it. Thanks so much for walking us through all that.
My pleasure. It's fascinating stuff.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.